Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Sapphic Culture Club. We're your hosts. I'm Laurel Hachinova.
And I'm Audrey Nee. For today's foray into the theme of lesbian chaos, we are very excited to have one of our favorite artists to talk about her solo show currently up at Cambium Gallery in Astoria, Oregon. Her name is Ami Pascal. Her show is called A Body Apart. Ami, thank you for joining us to talk about your work, which is a mostly visual medium on a podcast that is unquestionably not.
Thank you for having me.
Just a little bit of background. Ami Pascal is a queer, chronically ill artist and writer living in the Pacific Northwest. Ami is both self-taught and artist community learned, including with mentor Jillian Fry. Ami's paintings have shown in solo shows and group exhibitions in various Western states from Oregon to New Mexico and have been featured in multiple publications, including, as you may recall, the cover art for the 2023 book Queer for Fear.
All the dots are linking together.
I'm on the chart. Line connected.
Yay!
Yes.
That's like lesbian lines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Three lesbian ley lines.
Also, I'm realizing this is the first time I think you've been on our show solo.
That's right.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've earned my keep. I've earned my place.
We'll send you your microwave. It's already in the mail.
Yes.
Your Sapphic Culture Club branded microwave.
Oh, I want one.
So let's go back in time. Hmm. Everyone close your eyes and just think back to, you know, when you were a baby. So we'd love to hear a little bit about how you first got into art, into painting specifically, and what your relationship to art was like growing up.
I think I've always been drawn to art. My mom was very creative, expressed in a lot of crafts and arts, but not entirely channeled, if that makes sense. She had a very scattered and irreverent relationship to it, which is very her. So I always had a lot of art in my life and loved art, but I was not an artistic kid. I was not a kid that was seen as, you know, there are the kids who were the art kids. They were good at drawing and they were known for that. I was not that. I was the reader. I was good at reading. So that was, literature was more of the art form I had the first relationship with and the most like lifelong relationship with. I didn't get into painting until 2019.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So we were on a trip in Colombia in early 2019. In before times, in Cartagena.
Oh, wait. Did we mention Heather?
No. What do you mean?
Well, because we were in a trip. Yeah, we were.
The three of us were in this trip together.
Yeah, I remember. I remember. Don't you remember? We had so much fun. Thank you for clarifying. Yes, we, being my partner Heather and I, were on a trip in Colombia in early 2019. I had been incredibly overworked, very burnt out from my day job. And art travel had always been my main escape or release from that. We were good about traveling big trips, a few of them per year. And so we're on this trip in this beautiful coastal town. And they say that you shouldn't make big life decisions while you're on vacation. But, well, you know, refreshed by that vibrant coastal town and all the limonada de cocos, decided that I needed a hobby. And I decided I needed something creative and something just for me.
Hmm.
So I started Googling stuff and I started Googling like painting studios. It just was like, I've never tried that before. I should try that. And I found one in Portland that had community intro classes. And I signed up on the spot. And I went in person for a year. And that's where I met my mentor, Jolynne Fry. And it was a studio scenario. So you'd go, Jolynne would do a demo, and then you go to an easel, everyone was scattered across this studio. You go to your easel and you practice whatever things she had demoed. Sometimes it was color mixing. Sometimes it was a certain type of exercise or whatever. But other times you could just paint whatever. And there was a lot of still life stuff. So that was kind of the start of it.
And did it spark for you, like, with that first class?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Immediately. It was probably 2 or 3 classes. I actually still have the, because we'd practice on these just loose sheets of canvas. There was a Protea that I painted in this glass bottle, just all in red paint, like different values of red paint. And that was the first time I painted something that, like, it clicked. Like, I like this, and yeah. I can do this. Ooh, like, was a thing, and now I have a representation of that thing that I did. It just clicked.
That's so incredible. I have to say that's super inspiring, because I just made the assumption that you've been painting your whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also just classic lesbian chaos to be like, yeah, I'm not supposed to, like, make a huge, you know, life decision after or on a vacation, but fuck that, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. Turns out, saved my life. No bigs. You know.
Okay, well, let's fast forward a surprisingly few number of years to the pandemic. How did the pandemic change how you felt about art and your relationship to art making?
Yeah, it switched pretty quickly to being a practice at home. And Jolynne kept her classes, like her things, going online.
Oh, so you hadn't been painting at home? Like,
no,
at all until
I would paint every week. I would go to the studio and paint there. And that was my, like, one time of week that it was, I had a few hours for myself. That was just to do this thing. I think I was going Saturday mornings.
Well, your space was probably really different back then too, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And it felt like a good thing to go somewhere and do a thing. Yeah. So when the pandemic hit, they switched everything to online pretty immediately. And so Jolynne would do her demo over Zoom. And then the interesting thing is it completely changed the community. We now, instead of just being solo, we were interacting with each other more and giving each other feedback on each other's art. And it actually coalesced into something really incredible. It only just stopped, honestly. Jolynne only just stopped doing it fairly, like, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. This whole time she kept that going.
Yeah.
The online portion?
Yeah.
Oh,
it was,
wow.
She called it the Tuesday night art seminar or something like that. And we would just paint together and talk about each other's art. And it was a really special community and pretty incredible to see that format transform and become so enriched in an online format. I don't think anyone could have predicted that. So that was, like, a very functional way that it changed very beautifully and found a really nice form and rhythm. And I had a lot more time to paint. So I was painting a lot more than just those few hours one day a week. But really the biggest impact for me was getting sick with COVID. So I got sick. I was on a work trip in New York, February 2020, came back, brought COVID with me. That was mid-March. And sorry, Heather.
So we were just like,
we were just finding out.
Yeah. So did you know, like, that it was actually COVID at first? Because you were kind of an early adopter, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because it was so, I mean, I was like it's called First Wave.
Right.
I was just right in that pocket of I hightailed it home once they finally admitted, oh yeah, this is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And came home. It yes, it was a very clear one-to-one of that illness. So yeah, I got sick and ended up developing long COVID, also one of the first kind of guinea pigs of that. So more it was that my relationship to what I was painting was changing, and that took on new meaning. It was less about learning and more about expressing what I was going through and processing. And interestingly, I had been painting a lot of still lifes mm-hmm. at the studio. That's what Jolynn always would have, these just amazing random objects, everything from a shoe to a crystal. Mm-hmm. She always had these fabulous, huge range of objects in the studio. So that's what people would practice on. And I really liked the art of assembling still lifes. There's something about the assemblage, the meaning of it, each object, how they relate to each other, the story they're telling as a whole. And I think I felt a special affinity for still lifes because it was the subject most accessible to women painters back in the day. Yeah. And it is considered the least prestigious. It's still very looked down upon. So there is a little bit of that of course I'm like feel an immediate affinity towards. As well, there's a really interesting vein of still life painting called memento mori.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's also another term, vanitas. And memento mori basically means remember, you must die. And that it was imagery and objects used to communicate ideas of death and the fragility of life and time passing. And I felt a real connection to that and affinity towards that, and especially skulls and bones and flowers as expressions of a relationship to the fragility of life and death. So that subject matter started really connecting with me, and I was painting with more purpose at the same time, in terms of what I was painting. At the same time, I was so, so sick that there was a chunk of time that was all I could do.
Mm.
I couldn't walk much. I couldn't talk. I couldn't bathe myself. I couldn't feed myself. It was real bad for a while, but I could still paint.
Wow.
And so it became the only way I could really express myself. So in that, my relationship to it pretty dramatically, like in that first year of the illness, really dramatically changed.
So it feels like we're starting to see a through line for the thematic stuff, right? And I guess maybe this is a good time to dive into the current series. These aren't still lives. What's the next step in that evolution that gets us to A Body Apart?
This theme, I think, came about really organically and intuitively, which is generally how I think I approach both painting in general, but also in particular, each painting. I generally have a sense, but not a very hard and fast plan. So I had been painting some of my long COVID experience, certainly extending the memento mori theme. Also, Jolynn taught, she would do these lectures, I guess, or talks about how to paint from your body, how to paint what your body is experiencing and feeling. So I learned a lot of that from her.
Do you mean painting more intuitively? You mean feeling and then putting that
intuitively
on the canvas?
And almost like combining intuitive with embodied painting. So for example, there's one of the pieces called Not Much Left, and it's an abstract background with a torso figure in the middle. That background I painted in 2021, probably on probably one of my worst days ever. And it that is a actual rep that abstract background is an actual representation of what was going on in my body at the time. All of the pain, all of the weird dysfunction, electrical storms, like it's a manifestation of my illness. So that's an example of it. Jolynn describes it much better.
There's almost a sense of like synesthesia in some of your paintings. And that was the one that I was thinking of too, where it's like the color you use and the sort of power and almost violence. I would describe it as that. Yeah, I think you just summarized it perfectly. It's not like a shape you can describe, but it's a feeling of like this violence and like pain.
Right.
We should also take a second to point out in the show notes for this episode, we'll have links to Ami's work and a bunch of other stuff that we're going to talk about. So if you want to see
what we're talking
about, just click on the link. And it'll probably be most helpful if you check out the link to Ami's Instagram page. So head there now, and we're going to keep talking about the visual art.
So, yeah, I had that as a foundation, the combo of that with the themes from the Memento Mori work. And I was wanting to delve into that theme more. And I can't honestly remember what exactly unlocked it for me. It unfolded fairly organically. And I think it was as I was spending more time processing what it's like to be in this world in not just a queer body, but a broken body. And I've always been really drawn to artists like Frida Kahlo, but over the last maybe 6 years, I'd gotten to know this other painter and writer, Leonora Carrington. She was British, but lived in Mexico most of her life, did a lot of her painting there. She was a contemporary of, overlapped with Frida, as well as a lot of other amazing women painters in Mexico at the time. So Leonora Carrington and the Remedios Varo, I was really into their work. But it was the combination of the surrealness expressed in their work. And then I got this book of medical anatomy art. I can't remember if Heather got it for me or...
That sounds on brand.
Yeah, right? Seems right. Yeah. And I was really interested in that. And so having that as reference, it was the alchemy of those things. And I did a couple of pieces. And right in the back was one of the early ones. And Hollow, which isn't in the show, but those were some early ones, and it just really clicked.
Let's talk about the reference stuff, actually. So right in the back, one of the things that caught my attention in the series is that the figure that's in right in the back is also echoed in two other paintings. It's a recognizable figure. I feel like a lot of us have seen this particular image, and I hadn't thought about it too deeply until I saw it in your work. But when I did a little bit of research on it, I found out that it's usually called l'ange anatomique, or in English, and just to give people a sense for how people at the time, well, men mostly, were thinking about these images, it's also known as the flayed angel, which is so, I don't know, infuriatingly gross. But one of the things that I love about this whole series and what you do with your work is that you're taking these illustrations that were probably made on women who were discarded by society in life and also in death. And their bodies were just used as objects to teach men, you know, about anatomy. And they weren't treated with any respect. And so I love that you've taken these images and you've, one, brought them into the current. Like, they're so unfortunately painfully relevant for this time, like not just a pandemic, but like what marginalized bodies go through and have gone through for like centuries. But then also because you're using them in this context, it totally changes the meaning. And I hated the original illustration. It's really well done, but it's like just thinking about where it came from. But now in your work, it feels almost like it feels more alive. And I have, you know, that's a weird way to say it, but.
Can I just make the analogy? Sorry, Ami, I don't mean to jump in here. That
please.
I was thinking that this is almost like the 18th century version of male gaze in film. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen it referred to as like the medical gaze. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking like you are doing sort of the equivalent of Celine Sciamma, yeah, where it's not just the female gaze, but it's actually the gaze from the illness, right? It's like the sickness gaze. I'm not sure like what, you know,
yeah,
what we, let's just coin the term now, but right, you know, yeah, so congrats.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, as an aside, because you brought Celine up and really, we're just orbiting around her. Let's be real.
Always.
Filmmakers like Celine and more recently, Michelle Garza Cervera with Wisera, they're women who find new ways to show our experience and to put a new lens, so to speak, on what it's like being in this world. And so, yes, I think for me, that very much is a part of this. And I really appreciate hearing you see what I was trying to do, I guess, or thinking about your read of the use of medical and anatomy art. You know, the images really do capture the rawness and brokenness of illness and queerness and being in a vulnerable body and being in this world. And so that at a very just base literal visual representation of an experience, they work and immediately connected to my experience. But I did also think a lot about how people used their bodies used in this medical art. I'm using little finger quotes, art. They didn't volunteer or consent. And I did think about this as a bit of a reclamation and a conversion of their bodies, changing it from being something for white men's gains into something artful and queer. And this part wasn't conscious, but especially in thinking, getting ready to talk about the work, once I've put it out there and people ask questions, y'all are asking really smart, connected questions. So I've been having to find words to express things that just kind of happened. But it really mirrors what the surrealist women artists did. So surrealist, the women like Frida Kahlo, Leonora Carrington, Remedios Varo, Leonora Fenning, who's in Argentina at the time, also a contemporary of theirs. And there are a few other women. So, okay, first, let me disclaimer, I'm not an art historian. I am like B minus time traveler to the max of like terrible with history. So if there are any art historians out there listening and cringing at my very vague, hand wavy representation of this, like, don't come for me. Okay.
Let's be in chaos.
Yeah. I got the vibes. I got the general gist. So anyways, these women, we look at their work now and apply, you know, can apply the term surrealism to it. However, they were not really a part of the movement. To the surrealist men, and certainly other artist men, women were the muse. Ugh. And they were kept very outside of a few times. A couple of these women were included in kind of the official surrealist stuff. And a number of them had, you know, relationships with some of the men in the surrealist movement, you know, Breton's like very like cool boys club. Mm-hmm. But they were kept on the outside of it.
It is so crazy making to me that these men were like, oh, we're stretching the mind and consciousness, but like, this is as far as we go. Like, it's no, right. No, but like, no, not like that. Like, no, not women. You know?
I mean, we've never seen that repeated in history.
No. Very one-off. Yeah. So these women are just here telling their stories of their bodies and their existence in these very creative and imaginative ways. And what's interesting too is Frida Kahlo in particular never identified as being a surrealist, right? The others were I think a little bit more in that world. Certainly a couple of them through their relationships with men in officially in the surrealist movement. But she in particular talked about it and explicitly rejected it, actually. And she said something like, "What I paint isn't surreal, it's my reality." And I really felt that like deeply as
I just
like,
imagined all the men like shriveling up into tiny little like
they should, right? They should. Like it's like as a queer disabled woman, like I do just paint my reality. And it isn't maybe what everyone would expect. So anyways, there is an aspect of all of this that like I really do use the term surreal now, but much the way I would the word queer as mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. reclamation and as a non-normative expression of my reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah. And I love that you're continuing the tradition of like self-depiction. Like these are drawn from reference materials. I'm assuming that you didn't look at your own lungs to
what?
Paint. but I love that the response, the women's response to the males, the men who are surrealists wasn't like, oh, well, then we're going to paint men, you know? It's like, oh, you use women as muses? Well, we're going to, you know, take that subject matter and really just sort of step right over you because it's us and we're going to do it better.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of want to talk about specific pieces, but I realize, you know, the best way to kind of consume is to look at it. Although, who doesn't want to listen to us just like describe?
Describe things.
Let's talk about isolation.
It was interesting to me that you noted it being different from the other ones. Mm-hmm. The other one, the backgrounds are more abstract and liminal, I think was when we were touching base on this before, you used that word, which I loved and I think is spot on. The thing that's interesting to me is I didn't realize this consciously before as I was doing this. It felt just the same as the others to me. And I think I realized afterwards that being in the quote unquote real world now feels surreal and liminal to me.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I feel incredibly vulnerable and exposed. I'm usually the only one, Heather and I are usually the only ones masked. I do feel incredibly isolated, like ongoing, like at odds with the reality most people are trying to operate in. So it really is just as surreal as and liminal as the other environments the figures are in.
Maybe we should describe this piece. Amiya, maybe I'll let you do that.
Oh, no, you do it. I love, no, this is great.
No,
you do it.
Well, you were kind of alluding to this, but the majority, I think, of your pieces, you get the sense of they're all isolated for the most part, right? There's this figure. It's usually like a central figure that's kind of floating in a very, you know, abstract space. But there are a couple pieces in this one that we're talking about isolation where it's essentially a skinless body standing in what you might consider a real space, what appears to be, you know, a street, but there's something still so uncanny and beautifully disturbing about it. And I think a lot of it is actually in the expression of this person that doesn't have any skin.
And this is the heartbreaking thing about not being able to see this work in person, right? Is that
is to listen to us.
Yeah. That's okay. So there are at least two heartbreaking things about not being able to see this in person. Maybe one of the good things is that it forces you to zoom in, right? Mm. Like you mm-hmm. have to zoom in. And so if you look at the piece, if you look at isolation, there's this person on the right side of the image.
Sidewalk, yeah.
On a sidewalk, alone. The street is entirely deserted. It's all these houses that are really close together. You know, it's that kind of a neighborhood. But if you zoom into the face, you see that this person is actually, you get the sense that this person is tense, you know? There aren't even pupils. that you can see in the eyes, but you get the sense that this person is sort of looking, just based on the way that they're facing at you, or at like just past you. And there's actually one other piece where this happens, which is I think it's called On the Other Side. Is that the one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and these are, I think, the one of the few that have full body figures. And in that one, the figure does have sort of, it has two eyes. They have two eyes. And it's, please just look at these images. But you also get the sense that this person is looking at you in this very intense, it's very unnerving, both of these images.
Yeah. What is the scale of these, Ami, since we physically cannot be there, just to get an idea of what we would be confronted with in person?
Yeah, good question. A few of them are smaller. So the square, there are four square pieces, and like the heart and lungs and the head with all of the veins, those two. Mm. And then the grayscale images on the bright orange backgrounds, those four are all 12 by 12 okay. inches by 12 inches. So smaller. And then the largest one, which is eviscerated, it's the woman with the rays coming out of her. She is 3 feet long.
Wow.
So that's the scale, kind of smallest to biggest.
It's, I think, in particular hard to talk about your work because there's so much detail. It's like we're not talking about contemporary art where it's just like two colors or something, you know, like it's like there's so much detail and meaning in yours. So to describe it is doing it such an insane injustice that I apologize.
No, I think it's great. Actually, one thing I always make a priority is doing alt text for my artwork.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
Because I think it should be not optional. And it has made me work at finding words to describe images, or how would I summarize this? Sometimes I get really long and wordy, which I know actually for folks using screen readers isn't actually what always the most helpful thing, but sometimes I get very into describing it. So actually I really find it interesting, the act of finding words to describe a visual medium. I think there's something really beautiful in the difficulty of that.
Yeah, and I imagine for yourself as the artist, it's even more of a, at least an interesting challenge, because it's like, are you describing the sort of literal visual representation of it, or how do you like extract your own meaning behind it, you know?
Right.
So while we're on Isolation, the painting, I hadn't caught that you'd done this, but you've paired each of the paintings with a song. And just sitting with headphones and looking at the images and listening to the music really changes the experience. It kind of, it pulls the work into you in a really interesting way. So for Isolation, the song that you have is Thoroughfare by Ethel Kane. And what that song says to me is it's like this person searching through a specific, like all these locations to find love and themselves and connection. Right. And so, and in the piece that we're looking at, you have this person who's on this thoroughfare, right? They're on a street, and not to take it super literally, but you get that same draw, you get that same feel. So it's cool to be able to see it and then also kind of pull it in through your ears. What was behind the music pairings? Like, is this something that came after the works were completed, or were these also like songs that you happened to be listening to while you were making the paintings?
On loop for like
right, yeah.
8 hours, nonstop.
Actually, yes.
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. Mostly that. So the vast majority of these songs I listened to on loop for 2023. So for example, the song that pairs with Not Much Left is Down to Zero by Joan Armatrading.
And
that was my number one most played song in 2023.
Oh, wow.
If that tells you anything.
Right. Yeah.
And Thoroughfare was up there. I think that was number three. And I did listen to a lot of these songs on obsessive repeat, and they are literally infused into the paintings. In my mind and my experience of these paintings, when I look at them, I cannot separate them from the music. They informed each other, right? It is that interplay and that relationship between them that I'm just some weird meat sack conduit in between them. I don't know.
It's right? A weird experience, like listening to the music and looking at the painting, because it started to like almost pulse when I was looking at some of them.
That was the mushrooms, actually.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, you're right. There were a couple of them that the song came after, especially actually the smaller paintings. I paint them fast enough that it wasn't some of the bigger pieces. Mm. It's, you know, many hours, multiple sittings. And so that's when you can get something on loop. The smaller pieces happen faster. And so not all of them had the opportunity to have a song hook into it while I was painting it. I generally was in the, you know, the realm of certain genres of music. And certainly last year was listening to a lot of queer artists that feature, you know, pretty predominantly in this playlist. So there were a couple of them that were retroactively applied.
I think a lot of the music really like completes the painting for me. I mean, not that they're incomplete without it, but it feels more of this like three-dimensional experience where partly it's because you're using these techniques that visually, physically pull you in to your paintings, almost like a vortex, right? I feel like I'm getting sucked in. And then the music just kind of feels like what I should be hearing when I'm experiencing it. So earlier when I was introducing you, that was kind of what I meant by like mostly visual medium, right? Where I feel like it is actually this immersive experience you've created.
Yeah, it kind of like creates a synesthesia.
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't have it naturally, right.
You want to know what it's like.
If you want to know what it's like, Ami's, like curated for you. So
do you have like snack pairings that we could also just.
Oh. That's next level. I'm like, next show. Snack pairing.
Oh, I like that. You could have like scents and like. Mm-hmm. I'm curious because, again, we couldn't physically be there. Were you able to actually manifest this in the gallery in any way? The audio portion?
Yeah, at the opening, the gallerists, Carista and Audrey, they put on the playlist, but it was busy enough and there's enough conversation. Mm. It didn't really, I wanted like each person to have headphones, you know, like a silent disco, but at a gallery, you know, it's like you almost want that kind of experience. So it wasn't quite like that, but they did, you know, put it on for a bit.
I feel like the headphones are so important too, because, you know, we were talking about isolation earlier, but the audio isolation of just you and this music and the art is really, I could just like sleep there eternally, you know,
with or without skin.
Right. Without preferably.
Skin is optional. Yeah. That would have been a good alt title for your series.
Skin optional.
Yeah. So we have to wrap up, but is there anything, Ami, that you want to cover before we depart today?
No, it's like what you said. I mean, yes, there's so much more to say, but there's not enough time. So I don't know. I feel like,
we didn't even really get into time and like the time is warped and stopped in this series, but
that was the thing I was most thinking of, like, oh, actually there's a lot to say about time and space and place and queer, I think, queer time, crip time, I don't know if you know about that, like sick, chronically ill and disabled people, crip time is a thing, it moves differently, so all of that is in there.
Well, that's actually kind of like when you were talking about you're not a historian, you don't have like these very sort of you might be getting the history off. And I was like, but that's such a queer way to experience like history, you know, and this is such a queer experience of time. But
yes, exactly.
Well, I'm sure we'll have you back. And in the meantime, I do want to say that Ami's solo show will be up at the Cambium Gallery until March 4th if you happen to be in the Oregon or Washington area or mm-hmm. wherever you're swimming, you're coming in from the ocean. I don't know. But if you aren't local, it's totally okay because you can view and purchase mm-hmm. her artwork at the gallery's website, which we'll link to in the show notes. But it's also cambiumgallery.com. But I will say hurry because I've noticed your paintings are actually selling quite quickly. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Also, every time I'm like, I'm going to purchase this, I'm like, no, it's gone. But otherwise, Ami, where else can folks find you?
Folks can find me on Instagram at Ami is friend. And I guess I have a website, amipascal.com. I do have some paintings up there. I guess that's a thing I do. So I do have some paintings up there.
And also prints are available.
Oh, thank you. yes, you're right. Prints for the Queer for Fear cover artwork are for sale. There's a link to that in my bio on Instagram.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Ami, for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can find us on Instagram at Sapphic Culture Club, or you can email us about anything your heart desires at sapphiccultureclub@gmail.com.
And then lastly, as we've mentioned several times, you'll find links to things we've mentioned, as well as the episode transcript in the episode description, wherever you are listening to this podcast. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Really.
Such a privilege to have you.
Thank you so much.
Bye, everybody.